Today is May 18th, 2009. I'm at the Amelia Island Museum of History in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veteran History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Robert Raymond Hippler III, born on June 28, 1933 in New Orleans, Louisiana. My name is Frank Reitinger, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Okay, Bob, start us off and go for it.
Okay, Frank, thank you for this opportunity. Growing up as a kid, I was always interested in airplanes during World War II, making model airplanes. And while in high school, one of the local friends of mine interviewed me for a local paper, and I said I wanted to be an engineer and a pilot. You know, I had no idea what either one of them did, but I'd never even been around an airplane before. So I went on to Tulane and got my engineering degree, and while there, I joined ROTC and taking all the tests, the AFOQT tests, I kind of maxed out the pilot and navigator portions of those and the math portions because I'd be an engineer like math. And was commissioned a second lieutenant in May of 1955 at Tulane in New Orleans and had my engineering degree, but I was commissioned and got my diploma in my uniform. I went on to Lackman Field for indoctrination at the Air Force and got my physical and got a little scare there with some misunderstanding about the eye physical, but I eventually got that solved and was able to go on to flight school at Bartow Field in Florida in T-6s. Prior to, I was still a kid growing up, I had never even been close to an airplane, much less fly one, and I did get an opportunity during college to go in flight during ROTC, but this was my first time to really get into the business of learning how to fly an airplane, and of course the T-6 was very challenging, but a very good airplane. Spent 6 months there and went on to Greenville, Mississippi, and trained in a T-33 jet. First, we had to go through a T-28 because they thought it was too big a transition from going to from the T-6 to the T-33 jet. But I really enjoyed it and loved aerobatics and loved formation flying. It seemed like I just couldn't get close enough. The instructors tell me to back away. And I had one incident I always remember. An instructor was doing aerobatics for an instructor, and I was doing an Emblemen. And, you know, I did it kind of poorly. And he said, "Oh, you fly just like an old lady, you know." So he said, "Let me show you how to do it." He put it in dive, pulled it up, and got over the top, and said, "Okay, let's see if you can do one." So, man, by then I was steaming. I put it in dive, pulled it over the top, and about 10, 15 seconds later, he woke up and said, "What am I trying to do, tear the wings off the airplane?" But that was fun. I graduated second in my class, but because I wouldn't sign an indefinite status with the Air Force, I didn't get to choose until the 47th position, and so I ended up in B-47s, which was, I wanted to go to fighters. I really wanted F-100s in the worst way, but I wouldn't compromise my then position. So I went on to training at McConnell Air Force Base McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, Kansas. And there I trained as a co-pilot, and then from there I ended up in Lincoln, Nebraska, in the 98th Bomb Wing, and flying as a co-pilot. My aircraft commander was a real nice guy, but he was a World War II multi-engine, plane pilot. Never been in the jets much himself. Didn't have a lot of experience, and I had to kind of watch over him as a second lieutenant co-pilot, because one time I heard the airspeed sensing it building up, and they had some restrictions in our climb out, and I looked up and was going through 400 knots, and he was almost flying straight level at about 1,000 feet. So I ganked the stick and pulled it back and got us up. And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot." And another time I made the landing from the back seat because he was kind of having a hard time finding the runway. But I survived that. The poor man had some other problems, and eventually, so I think he committed suicide, which is really sane. But after a year there, they had an early release program, and I still had ideas of being an engineer as well. I mean, I had the degree in engineering, but I never practiced it. So I took the early release and went back to New Orleans and was kind of doing work for the telephone company as an engineer, but I was kind of bored with it, you know, having my experience in flying. And I really wanted to go back to flying. I started flying with the Air Force Reserve and C-119s. And I was really enjoying it, although C-119 was not a, you know, glamorous airplane, but it was a lot of fun to fly. Did short field takeoffs and landings and all those kind of things. And on one little trip over to Texas, to the airbase there, airbase there in Texas, or south of Texas, I can't think of the name of it now, I was taking a night flight back from there back to New Orleans and lost all electrical power. Mm-hmm. Well, immediately got my flashlight out so I could see the entrance that still worked, you know, and then flight engineer jumped up on her back, and this APU up there was always hard to start, but he got that thing started in no time at all. So we were back on the ground and got it all fixed and then went on back to New Orleans. I was getting bored with the work. I put an application to a couple other jobs, and about the time, and I heard about this early recall for by SAC for a shortage of pilots and co-pilots and navigators. And so I put an application in with the Air Force for recall. And about the time I got an approval to go back into the Air Force, I got an offer from Lockheed Aircraft to go work in the C-130 program. I said, well, the C-130 program might not last very long, you know. That's a laugh because it's, you know, how long it's still in existence. But I did choose to go back in the Air Force and don't regret a day of it, you know. So they sent me back to Lincoln, Nebraska, and assigned me to a what they call a lead crew. And it was a major, it was the aircraft commander, and he had a spot promotion as an aircraft commander, and the navigator was a major also. He had a spot promotion as a navigator, and I was still just a first lieutenant at that time. And I flew with them. We had some interesting experiences flying across the Atlantic one time coming back from a reflex tour to England. The navigator was looking for our tanker plane. We were supposed to meet him out over the coast of just south of Greenland to refuel before we'd come on back to Lincoln, Nebraska. Well, we knew we had some strong headwinds, but we didn't know how much. I was trying to call the tanker on the radio, and I finally got him on HF radio, and he had been waiting for an hour with us, and then for us, ended up flying back to Harmon Field in Newfoundland to land because he said we were just so late. Well, it turned out we saw, before I got a hold of him, the navigator saw a beacon, and we went down from altitude down to meet the tanker. It was a KC-97, so we had to go down to about 15,000 feet. And there was we went right past the beacon and then circled back and realized that it was a spoof that the Russians were doing with these Russian trawlers. So in the meantime, we were getting really short on fuel. I finally got a hold of the tanker before he landed at Newfoundland, got him to turn around, come back and meet us. And I think we had 6,000 pounds of fuel left when we finally hit the tanker, which was about, you know, 20 minutes worth of flying. So we were really lucky. From there, they sent me to squadron officer school, and then after squadron officer school, back to Lincoln. And in no time at all, it seemed like it was less than a year, just about a year and a few months after I got back in Air Force, they asked me if I wanted to upgrade to aircraft commander as a first lieutenant. And I said, oh, yes, definitely. So they sent me down to McConnell Air Force Base to upgrade as an aircraft commander in the B-47s. At that time, you know, prior to then, most of the aircraft commanders were either senior captains or majors or above. And, you know, the idea of having first lieutenants as aircraft commanders was kind of unusual, and so I was real proud to do that. I got that finish and graduated from that training as an outstanding crew member, and then went back to Lincoln, Nebraska, where I picked up a navigator and a co-pilot, and the navigator was a first lieutenant named Walter Rebau. The first co-pilot I had, you know, he was kind of frustrated. He wanted to be in fighters, and he kind of really was always arguing with the navigator. I had to kind of chew them out sometimes in a flight because they wouldn't agree on things. You know, co-pilot had to do a lot in the back seat because I had been there, and they had to shoot the stars. They had to operate the 20-millimeter guns out of the back of the airplane if a fighter ever came up against you and so forth. So it was and B-47 was a very unique airplane. It was, you know, originally designed in 1947 and really started getting into the Air Force in the early mid-50s, and so this wasn't too long, and after that, this time period, we're talking about now in 1960 when I was the aircraft commander. We made a number of reflex tours to both to England and to over to Spain, and on one reflex tour to England, it was kind of unique because, you know, they were pretty long flights, maybe 9 to 10 hour flights where you're sitting in an ejection seat with a helmet on, an oxygen mask, and a parachute. You know, you don't move around very much at all, and eating these cold box lunches. But on this one flight back to England, the weather was so bad, they said, we have to divert down to Spain, to Zaragoza, Spain. And so they had to send a tanker up to get us and give us more fuel so we could get down to Spain. It ended up being like a 13-hour flight, and that'd be 47. So I was, you know, we were a good, tired crew. Went to the officers' club that night, and that was my first time I had paella. Wow. You know, I never had been to anything like that before. In any event, we had a lot of good experiences flying B-47s, and you know, we spent a lot of time on alert duty, 7 days on alert duty, and these were EWO missions. We were prepared, and this was during the Cold War. Our targets were in Russia, and our idea was if you were in a station and you got called to go, you had to get off the ground as soon as possible and fly out to a certain point, and if you got a go-code message, and of course along the way you'd refuel and so forth, then you might go all the way to war. Initially, when I was flying, we were doing high-level bomb, practicing for high-level bombing. And in fact, one night we was doing a practice, and there wasn't too many civilian airplanes back then flying up at that altitude, but the traffic control people told me they had another unidentified aircraft up at our altitude and for us to climb. Well, I hit the wheel on the autopilot to climb and immediately hit the release of the autopilot and pull back on the stick. And then when we got past that situation, I pushed forward on the stick. I couldn't get it to go forward. And I'm pushing like hell. I said, co-pilot, push the throttle on the stick. We were going to run out of airspeed. And then it dawned on me that the autopilot didn't click off, and I ran down and went, reached down manually and turned it off. And, you know, there's a little incident, but nothing. You know, things stick in your mind. We trained a lot, and then over for our reflex tours in England, we were like only 2.5 hours from target. Well, by then we went from high-level bombing to low-level bombing, so we did a lot of practice at low-level flying over there. But the missions called for us to go in low-level below the radar and then release our bombs on target, dodging SAM sites. We knew where the SAM sites were and all that stuff. And then, because we didn't have enough fuel, we were supposed to climb out to high level and go all the way down to Turkey. You know, and I said to my crew, I said, it's a one-way mission anyway. I mean, if we survive the thing at all, we're not going to survive getting all the way down to Turkey because they're going to shoot us on the way out. So there were some safe spots up in Finland that they had designated safe areas. So I told my crew, says, if this ever comes to pass, we're going there, we're going to bail out, leave the airplane go. I mean, because it's not going to be two strikes in an all-out nuclear war, and that was it. You know, we were carrying different types of weapon systems, you know, for atomic, hydrogen bombs and so forth. So, I mean, you know, it was a lot of responsibility as a young man. One particular event that really struck home with me was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was over, we were actually in R&R when an officer's club waiting to go back to England in Germany, and we heard the loudspeaker come on, and here was President Kennedy announcing about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And immediately after that, we there was an announcement on the loudspeaker for all the SAC pilots to report the flight line, you know. So they got us back in England right away, put us all on alert. And they had planes that had extra planes. They got every plane they could get together, every B-47 they could find, they put them on alert. So we went on alert, and it says, no more practice alerts. Your crew stays together like glue, you know. And but we could go around the base a little bit, but we couldn't go anywhere other than a few places. So I needed a haircut and went to the old club. They had a barber at the old club, and I was getting a haircut, and all of a sudden the klaxon went off. That's it. We were on a war. It's kind of, you know, frightening when you think about it, but at that time you were trained to react. I pulled the apron off my chest and ran out the door, got in that Ford station wagon, going down to the across the base. The police were waving us through, hit the flight line, and got to the airplane. And then the procedure was to start all six engines before you go. Well, I got three engines started, and I started taxiing because I'm going to be number one. I was number one at the end of the runway, and I kept calling the command post for radio check. I said, loud and clear, standby, standby. So what? You know, where's the message? We're supposed to get a message. They didn't give us a message. I kept saying, where's our message? You know. And finally, after about 15 minutes, seemed like, you know, we had about 15 airplanes all lined up behind me at the end of the runway, ready to go. And they said somebody made a mistake, and that was a big screw up. Just, you know, it downgraded the bomber force at that time, at least for that base. But anyway, we recovered from that, and eventually got back to flew back to Lincoln, Nebraska, on a KC-135, and got back on alert again over there, over in Lincoln, Nebraska. And you know, finally, as everybody knows, Kennedy. You know, was strong and got the crisis ended and so forth. I really enjoyed my time in B-47s and didn't want to go to B-52s. Would have been happy to go to B-58s, but they came out with this Minuteman program where they had an education program. So I volunteered for that, and that was in the first base that we're doing that is Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, Great Falls, Montana. And I thought that'd be fun. That'd be, you know, some place to go. And I'll get a master's degree. And I always wanted to get a master's degree. So I volunteered for that. But I ended up being accepted to go to Ellsworth Air Force Base up in South Dakota, Rapid City, South Dakota. So I got up to Ellsworth Air Force Base. I had to make some training Chanute Air Force Base in Illinois on all the technical aspects of the Minuteman missile system, and then some operational aspects of it out of Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. Even got to watch them launch a Minuteman missile, which is quite spectacular because it's all solid fuel, and when it comes out of the ground, I mean, it comes from silos, it kind of just goes zip and it tilts over and it's gone. I mean, before you can, you know, you just see it, it's just unbelievable. It's just like you see a bottle rocket go up pretty fast when you think about a three-stage missile doing that. You know, that could go 6,000 miles or more. Minuteman duty was very interesting, but it was sitting in a capsule 75 feet below ground, you know. Fortunately, when I arrived there, because of my aircraft background and my experience in standboard, I was placed on a standardization crew as a deputy combat crew commander. And Minuteman missiles, you're in a camp when you're on alert duty in Minuteman missiles, you're on for 24 hours. And then you have a two-man policy. You're in this capsule on the ground. It's like a big concrete, it's about 4 or 5 foot thick walls, and it has a blast door. It looks like a big bank vault door, you know, about 4 feet thick to get in and out of that thing. And, excuse me a second. The people above are the security people and so forth. Each capsule controlled 10 missiles. So you have all this electronics in there, and you have two positions in the capsule, one for the commander, the crew commander, and one for the deputy crew commander. And they had keys. you weren't, you know, within arm's reach of each other. And if you ever were going to launch these missiles, you know, you had to turn these feet simultaneously. It was like, you know, not even a second delay between them. So there's no way that one guy could do, you know, do both of them at the same time and launch them. And you had lights that showed the security status of these missiles all the time. And occasionally they came out and did maintenance on them. Sometimes the experiences were kind of, you know, boring, but, you know, every now and then you'd get the alerts, whistles go off or something, that something was intruding, and they'd send the security team out to check that missile, because the missile sites were about 3 to 5 miles away from where the command capsule was. So they were all dispersed. The 10 missiles were dispersed all around the countryside. So these guys had went over there and checked that out, and they'd say, well, it's a rabbit or antelope or something set up the alarm. They were fenced around there, but sometimes, you know, animals can get inside the fenced area. One night we were there, though, and the weather got so bad, and this was South Dakota, the security people couldn't even get out with the snow cats. They had snow cats as well, so they couldn't get out with snow cats, and the people couldn't get to relieve us the next morning, so we ended up spending 48 hours on work duty there.
Okay. Great, Bob.
Yeah. A few other things about the B-47. It was a very interesting aircraft, and remember, it was designed in late 40s, right after World War II, and Boeing, used the data from some of the German scientists about the sweep of the wings, and actually did a lot of tests. And when the first B-47 came out, nobody in the Air Force was really interested in it until a SAC general went to a Boeing plant, and they invited him to go for a test flight in a B-47, and he said, man, that's a fantastic airplane. And of course they built and actually over 2,000 of them over the period of time of these airplanes, and they increased and improved in models and so forth. The original plane was designed to fly at 125,000 pounds gross weight, and by the time SAC got finished adding everything to it, our EWO, which is the emergency war order gross weight, was 221,000 pounds. So they had to strap JATO bottles on the bottom of them. And they put 33 JATO bottles. That's each bottle has 1,000 pounds of thrust. So you had 33,000 pounds of thrust. The engines were only like a little over 6,000 pounds of thrust each. So with all our engines running, that was about 38,000 pounds of thrust, and then we got another 33, so it really gave you a jolt, but it only lasted about 25 seconds. So you go down a runway, you hit the bottles, and it just boots you right up in the air, and then the bottles would kill, but by then you get enough airspeed, and you put the nose down, and you drop the bottles, the whole rack of JATO bottles. The B-47 had good capabilities at low level. It could fly up to 425 knots indicated airspeed, and at high level, you had to reach a balance. It was a very, you know, underpowered airplane, and to get up to altitude took sometimes 30 minutes. But at high level, it did pretty good. But we usually flew about Mach 0.74 or up to Mach 0.81. That was about as fast as we could ever go. One little interesting tidbit about the B-47. If you were down a low level flying and you went above 456 knots indicated airspeed, the wings would then become like control surfaces, and it would bend the wings, so you'd get what they call aileron reversal. So if you pulled the wheel to turn left, the airplane would go right, so you never wanted to get above that speed. On one low level training exercise in Kansas, I was flying along, and we were going along pretty good, practicing low level, about 500 feet over the ground at about then around 400 knots maybe, and one of the chances we could get to fly at a higher airspeed. And I saw this farmer on a tractor up ahead of me, and of course we weren't exceeding the speed of sound, but the sound is still kind of behind you. And when I got close enough to where he heard that roar of six engines blasting away, he went bailing off that tractor, hit the dirt. He didn't know what was coming. He thought a tornado was after him. I really felt bad about the man, but we all, you know, have to laugh about it from time to time. I had another incident in the B-47, kind of scared me a little bit. I was taken off one night, and some bad weather all around us, and something happened, and my parachute popped. And I was sitting on an ejection seat with a parachute that wouldn't have been any good because it got all tangled because it had already popped, and I was sitting. Unfortunately, we carried an extra parachute in the plane, and I was, once I got down to it, I was able to exchange parachutes and put a good parachute on. In any event, I went back into the missiles in a silo operation. It was very interesting working in the missiles and teaching people about them, especially people who were not operational people, as I had been through most of my career in SAC. And I stayed there for a while and worked with the crews and did a lot of things and enjoyed the missile duty, enjoyed Rapid City, and learned how to ski while I was up there, and a couple of my children did as well. But I was notified I was going back to the cockpit, and December of 1965, I got a notice that I was going to report in, I think it was March or June, whatever it was, May, June of 1966, to CCT-01, Combat Crew Training 01. I said, what is Combat Crew Training 01? I had no idea. I went to the base personnel, they didn't know. We finally found out that it was training in a what the Air Force called an 01, which is nothing more than an Army L-19 that the Army used for training. Of course, found out that later on that they were forward air controllers that used these things in Vietnam. So I immediately started trying to get changed. I wanted to fly something like an A-1E, you know, that was a good little fighter plane. It was an old Navy plane, but the Air Force used them too, and they had a good capability and so forth. And I knew I had been flying, and I hadn't been out of the bombers, and I hadn't been into single engine jets since flight school, so I knew I wouldn't get into fighters and jets. I thought, well, they'd let me. I was flying a C-47 for my flying time in Rapid City, so back in props again, so I knew how to fly props and all that stuff. But the Air Force said, no, they really need me as a forward air controller. So I ended up going to Hurlbut Field in Florida to train as an O-1 pilot, and we did all the training there on the airplanes and the tactics of forward air controller tactics, and even in some cases forward air controllers end up as being on the ground. And so I ended up doing that for about 6 months or less. And in July of 1966, I started heading to Vietnam. I got to fly the last prop plane over there, which was a DC-6 from San Francisco all the way to the Philippines, and that like took forever, it seemed like, it's very slow. We landed up at Hawaii, and a couple of us jumped off and got some Mai Tais and back on a plane, and stopped at Wake Island and then on to the Philippines and got to the Clark Air Force Base in the middle of the night. They didn't have any place on base for me to stay. They put me in a cab with a guy that didn't speak English, and I didn't speak, Philippines, Spanish, or whatever it was. And he dropped me off on a street with a little light down at the end of the alley, and kept pointing down there. I said, the hotel down there? He shook his head, so I went down there. It was crude, but it was a hotel. It was air-conditioned, and I was tired as anything by then. The next day, we were supposed to go to Jungle Survival School, and they said, no, that's been canceled. You can't go to Jungle Survival School. You have to go to right on Vietnam. We need you too badly over there. So I had been to survival school during SAC at Stead Air Force Base in the mountains, survival and all that stuff, but never really jungle survival. So I wasn't unhappy to miss that. I was ready to go and get on with it. So we hung around there. They didn't have a plane for it. So after a couple of days, they needed so badly, but they couldn't get us a flight over there. We just said, the heck with it. We went to the flight line, brought our B-4 bags and stuff with us, and caught a ride on a C-130 over to Vietnam. Landed in Vietnam, and they were having a mortar attack at the same time. Always ran into a bunker somewhere, and then ended up sleeping in some barracks somewhere with double-decker bunks and so forth. And I went to report to the colonel, and he says, we were waiting to see the colonel at the unit we were assigned to, and there was a board house there that had KIA you know, missing in action, a KIA, and sometimes they'd say where the base was located, and then they kept saying KIA, KIA classified. And so first thing he does, we get, there were three of us going to the office, and he says, we need two volunteers to go to this classified location. Of course, we all sat there with our hands, you know, kind of hiding behind our backs, you know. And so he picks me and this other guy to go to this classified location in the Nakhon Phanom, Thailand. NKP for short, but Nakhon Phanom, Thailand became known as Naked Fanny to most of us. So we went on a flight over to Nakhon Phanom, Thailand, where I got introduced to the area and so forth, and learned about what our mission was there. And the mission in the Nakhon Phanom, Thailand, was to fly up and down Ho Chi Minh Trail and to interdict the trucks and supplies going down from North Vietnam down into South Vietnam. We stayed, we trained, and we flew in pairs because the area was completely unfriendly. There was no friendlies on the ground in that area. Laos, I always considered as a shell of a country. At that time, you had two brothers, and I can't remember their names, that were princesses or something of Laos, that were fighting each other for control of the opium crops and so forth. But when we flew around that area, it was a very beautiful country. They had some farmland, and then, you know, they had a lot of rice paddies and so forth, and a big karst comes sticking, just like somebody shoved a rock straight up out of the ground, go up for 1,000 feet or so. And very pretty, and in fact, some of these karst, you could look into like a cave in there and see a Buddhist statue, and there were Buddhist temples around it, we'd say, too. When we flew our missions, we flew with low level, going and coming from the area, because we didn't want them to know, you know, if there's anybody on the ground. We stayed low, they couldn't hardly hear us until we got up to our area, and then we didn't go up very high there. But when I say low level, we were flying, you know, sometimes, you know, 10 feet off the ground. And in fact, one time, this little side story, I was coming back from a mission. We were flying back low level as we always did. And I looked on both sides, and all of a sudden, looking in front of me, here's a big elephant standing in front of me. And I had to, you know, peel off to keep him hitting the side of the elephant. I just see him say, a fact pilot killed by elephant. But the forward air control was, you know, go back to World War II, where we used them in fighting in World War II, and they had some real good stories there. And in fact, they used T-6s then. And then they used them in Korea as well. They used T-6s, I believe, forward air controls in Korea as well. And I guess when the Vietnam War started off, they just didn't have enough planes available that were really needed. And they finally eventually changed the from the L-19 to a, they call it a Cessna, I forget the Cessna designation, but it was O2, the Air Force called it. It had two engines, a pusher and a puller. And then eventually they got the little Warthog, which was really a plane designed to be a close air support for an air control plane. But while we were there, we were having to make do, you know, with what we had, and flying a lot of missions, went in pairs. One guy flew high, and he was there to kind of protect the guy flying low, and so the guy flying low was really doing the job. Now, sometimes the job involved a lot of just reconnaissance, looking for what was happening. The North Vietnamese had made a deal with Laos, apparently in the 50s or in the 60s, where they could bring stuff and roads into Laos to go south into Vietnam. And that might have been back when they were fighting the French way back then, too. In any event, a lot of these roads were, you couldn't see them under a thick, you know, canopy of trees and so forth. Eventually, the Air Force got there with Agent Orange and defoliate a lot of them. But every time you'd find, you'd uncover one road, they'd build another one under these canopy of trees. Some of these trees were pretty high up. And as I said, the terrain was pretty rough. The living conditions on the base, before going to the missions, the living conditions on the base were at first kind of primitive. When I first got there, we were like in a big open bay barracks with about 20 guys living in little bunks, double-decker bunks and so forth. And then eventually they built these little H-shaped hooches, we call them. In the middle bar of the H was a latrines, you know, showers and toilet facilities and so forth. And on the sides that were up on a deck area, they were just screened in with some wood, but screens around, not air conditioning or anything else. And they had them, it was big, long bays, but they had them divided off into like two guys in a room, and you had your blockers between you. And weather was pretty warm there. In fact, when we got there, it was like monsoon season, so it was really, really wet around there. I mean, the hooches were fairly comfortable. In wintertime, we got a blanket, and sometimes I put a poncho on top of the blanket when it got a little cool, but most of the time it was pretty warm down there, so we didn't have to worry about, you know, really heat in those kind of places. another little interesting story about the town of Nakhon Phanom. It's right on the Mekong River, right across from Laos. You look across the river and you see Laos, and they had some restaurants in there, most of which we kind of avoided because it just looked so weird. And finally, we had these Thai officers that were assigned to our unit, and they would fly in the back seat because they had some road watch teams over there in Laos that were trying to keep an eye on what was going on, and then they'd call in by FM radio. And so these Thai officers would talk to them on the radio and backseat our plane. But one night, one of the Thai officers, a Major Pong, invited us to go down to dinner with him downtown. So a couple of us said, okay, that sounds good. And so he takes us into this one restaurant we'd seen a lot of times, but we never went in because the first thing you'd look in there, you see dogs and cats on the floor. And you see these people cooking over walks right as you go in and so forth. But it was right on a river. So we finally went in with him, and the food was just wonderful. You know, you had to kind of overlook the dogs and cats on the floor and the gecko lizards saying F you and all these things. How they made that sound on the walls crawling around, but the food was great. And so we got to go back there fairly often. In fact, the only question we had there for the Thai officers, they carried guns. We couldn't leave the base with a pistol. We had pistols. Each of us had our own pistol and rifles, but we got there, and I asked one guy, I said, why do you carry pistols? He said, well, this town's not always completely friendly to us. And I said, why is that? He says, well, during the French War, they had a lot of North Vietnamese that came here. And he said, you see that tower? They had a big tower in the middle of the street there with a bell clock type tower in the middle of the street. He said, that was donated to town by Ho Chi Minh. I said, oh, my God, you know. And we knew that they would shoot at us every now and then when we'd fly over the town or anywhere close to the town. But anyway, that was a very interesting little town. I'd like to go back there someday if I ever had a chance. But going back to the missions and flying, we flew high and low. I became the squadron scheduling officer, and we had some hot areas and some not-so-hot areas, but ended up you know, trying to balance it off for the people that were there. We had a lot of interesting experiences. The fighters that we got in were, a lot of them we would get fragged for certain targets, and a lot of times the fighters would come to us that they couldn't get to their targets in North Vietnam, and a lot of them were at bases right there in Thailand, and occasionally we'd get fighters from carriers, Navy fighters from carriers out in the ocean there off the coast of Vietnam. The fighters, for the most part, were jets, and they couldn't see the targets that we had. That might have been a truck park or munition supplies or something like that we would find at low level on the ground by looking under the sideways on the canopy of trees and so forth. We had some choke points on, we call them choke points on the side of hills, where, you know, it was a good place to bomb the road and put a hole in it so that they couldn't get traffic through it. They did have, ability to move at nighttime, a lot of them, and so eventually we started flying night flying, but I'll come to that in a minute here. The rainy season, as I mentioned earlier, was really quite something, but you know, you fly over the town and you might see a kid riding on the back of a water buffalo in town because, you know, the water was, you know, way steep or so forth in there. There was two wars going on. I mean, by now everybody's heard about Air America and Continental Air Service and some other people like that that were flying over there and doing other missions that were not really directly related to Vietnam. One day we got a frag to put in some T-28s against some targets that were not part of the war of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so I was, you know, chosen to do the job, and I had a lieutenant colonel as my wingman who was just brand new to the squadron, so he was flying. I was the captain at the time, and he was flying my high position. So normally when we get a set of fighters, they'd come in and fight a set of four fighters. They'd come in formation, and we'd mark the target with our smoke rockets. We carry these 2.575 Willie Pete rockets. We'd carry four of them, two in each wing, and we could fire them one at a time. Now, they weren't bore sighted, so they couldn't, you know, you couldn't hit anything that you were aiming at with them because you didn't even have a sighting device. We had a little piece of metal sticking up on the front of the cowling that we'd kind of use to get a little idea where we're shooting at with them. But we marked the target. So, like I said, normally you'd have a set of four fighters come in at one time. And we had met some of these Laotian pilots that come up and visit us from time to time, and they spoke fairly decent English. Well, on this mission, they were kind of concerned about communication, so we took another observer in the back seat of from us, and I think he was Thai, to relay instructions, but he had to relay them back to our base about 100 miles to the west over there in the Nakhon Phanom. So we were up there flying. Well, when I got ready, they called me and they come inbound, and I had to do everything through this interpreter in the back seat. And they came in a flight of 12. 12, you know, like it was a mass gaggle of T-28s. And, you know, so I was kind of concerned about that. And I said, well, your job is to keep yourself clear. I told the colonel, just stay out the way. Get high and back and out the way, because this is going to be a mess. And so the target was in the side of one of these big cars, you know. Well, I marked the target, and boy, they started in bombing and strafing and doing all the thing, and I kind of got up above them. I always would get right above the target area where I could see everything, and they would kind of do their bombing below me and then pull off and go around. And I was kind of dodging them and watching where they were heading and telling instructions and so forth. And all of a sudden, we started getting a lot of ground fire from the target area and so forth, and they were shooting at us, shooting at me, and shooting at them, and there was bullets flying all over the place. Well, these guys decided to go start bombing somewhere else, you know, and so I'm hollering at them and telling the guy in the back seat, get them back here, you know, this is the target. I'm just mad as a hornet, but, you know, it's one of those things, you know, you're out of control, and we finally got through with that thing, and they went on back to their base, and I went back to mine just mad as a hornet because, you know, it was kind of dangerous out there. And in any event, the colonel decided we needed a medal for that. And he was out of the way not doing anything, and I was down there in the mix of all those T-28s flying around me and the bullets flying around me and everything else. So I said, well, whatever you want. I don't put myself in for medal. So he put us in for medal, and we ended up with a DFC. Both him and I ended up with a Distinguished Flying Cross. Sometime after that, I think it was September 1966, they asked for some of us to go to Dong Ha, which is a Marine base just south of the DMZ, to test our concept of flying the O-1s, the L-19s at nighttime with a starlight scope. And I was a little concerned about that because the L-19 hasn't got the instrumentation for night flying or instrument flying of any kind. You know, it's basically airspeed, altitude, and that's it, you know, and a whiskey compass. So I went over with a couple of guys, and we spent about 3 weeks there. And we did flying mostly in North Vietnam, just south of DMZ. And I had flown into North Vietnam a number of times in some of our radio missions from the Nakhon Phanom. And so there we was kind of flying up there in North Vietnam. It was a little weird flying up there, knowing where we were and so forth. And We did one night flight, I remember, and we had to go after B-52 had bombed in that area, and using a starlight scope, and you can see quite well out of it, you know, and it's amazing to what you can see on the ground. The only problem is that we don't have the instrumentation. They put a beacon on our plane so that the radar people could track us, but I didn't quite trust them, and I was following the map reading at the same time when I was flying in the back seat, looking at the starlight scope and map reading at the same time and listening to the direction, and I told the pilot, I said, look, don't turn that direction because they run us to the side of a mountain. We were like around 1,500, 2,000 feet, and there was a 3,500-foot mountain or hill in front of us, and I said, if you turn that way, we're going to be gone. So we backed off. We went back to our base at Confanam, and ended up there for doing the rest of our missions and work and so forth, and we ended up doing night flying. But as I said, I was a scheduling officer, so I didn't really do much night flying because I had to do the schedules. We had 50 pilots, and we were flying 60 missions a day. Jeez. And so I had, you know, a lot of work to do and fly myself, and I'd fly, some of our pilots fly two or three missions. We weren't officially at that time part of the Vietnam War, even though that's what we were doing. We weren't authorized R&R, so we made our own R&R. I would schedule everybody so we had enough time we could release two or three guys for about a three-day trip down to Bangkok, where they'd go and unwind for a couple of days and come back. So we did that, and it was really truck bulldozers and that kind of stuff. And I think one day, October 1st, 1966, that I have a little diary that I kind of kept track of some of these things. And I saw this, what looked like bulldozer tracks on the side of a road, and going up around a mountain, because they had little clumps of grass like a tracks of a bulldozer would leave, and every time we'd put a hole in the road, bulldozers would come in, went there and fill it in, and there'd be trucks going through it again. So I got down real low, and my wingman kind of apparently lost sight of me, and I was kind of turning around this side of this hill really low. I mean, I was looking up at the hill and looking at the road, trying to look under the canopy of trees for where they might have hidden this bulldozer. And all of a sudden, I heard all this noise. And there's traces going everywhere. I mean, everywhere I looked up, and it was just, you know, it looked like about 3 foot long, you know, white streaks going through the sky. And I could hear all this noise. And because I always flew with the windows open in that little plane, it only flew 85 miles an hour. So I flew with the windows open so I could hear. Because I know a lot of times they'd shoot at you, you could hear, the 30-06s or whatever they were using down on the ground, and this was really rattling, and it was loud, and I rolled wings level for just a second, and I was looking right down the barrel of some quad 50s, 50 caliber, you know, quad 50s that were right on the side of a little riverbank, and I knew if I pulled up I was dead, and I didn't have much room, but I was able to go down lower, and I put the power to the firewall, and I was trying to talk to my wingman with my mic button depressed, but he couldn't hear me, and he had lost sight of me. And I went right at him and down a riverbed. They had a riverbed. They were right on the other side of this river, and I went down this riverbed, and it was sheer rock and across each side. And I was just flying a little old L-19 right between all those rocks and everything else, and finally got around a curve where they stopped shooting at me. I mean, I thought I was dead. I mean, I really did. I had 1 minute. I had one hole in the airplane. That was it.
Wow.
So, and the rest of Vietnam and Thailand was really sad, because we had we started losing people, you know, and that's when, you know, I really thought it was kind of rough. We lost a pilot. They had lost four pilots in the early phase of the operation at Confanam before we got there. And then we went along for several months without a loss, and then here January of 67, we had our first loss of a pilot, and it really shook me up. There was a young man, and we had gotten in some new second lieutenants right out of flight school, and that was for both dangerous kind, and we lost him, and we lost an F-4 pilot along the way, and then we lost another pilot, and February of 67. We had lots of, the action was really picking up and getting worse and worse. And then we had another pilot that we lost in 67 as well, or early 67, who he was a captain. I won't say his name because he did exactly what I told him not to. He was Air Force Academy graduate, and he was trying to make a name for himself. And we had one of the worst places you could be was Magia Pass, and we always had to stay clear, or because it was a very sheer area where a road came through a mountain pass. And I said, whatever you do, do not ever go on the east side of Magia Pass. And I had briefed him, checked him out in the area, and this day he went on the east side of Magia Pass. Ended up having a bail. I got shot up and ended up having a bailout. Got on the ground, called in the fighters, the Sandys and the Jolly Greens. And then they had to back off because we were getting too much ground fire. And he went into hiding. About a couple hours later, he got on the radio again and talked to a fighter. And the Sandys net went back in. Well, the Vietnamese had set up a trap. And the JP went down into the jungle from the Jolly Green, got him on a sling, got him into the airplane, put him in the seat and strapped him in, and he was putting on his own parachute when they blew the helicopter.
Oh, boy.
And his mistake cost us the whole helicopter crew. The JP was blown up the back end, and there was a big write-up of him in the Airman's Magazine years later. He did a wonderful job in getting out of there. I ended up rotating back to the States in April of 67. I was curtailed 2 months from my my full year assignment because I flew 45 missions into North Vietnam. Out of 185 missions and 500 combat hours. I ended up teaching ROTC at Tulane and really enjoyed that, except that this was in 1967 to 70 when everything was anti-military and anti-government, and we were, being harassed all the time, and I couldn't wait to leave there. And when my time came to rotate, I was very ready to go, except my mother had gotten cancer, and I wanted to stay close by, so I took an assignment teaching Vietnamese how to fly. So I was assigned to the T-28 training over at Keesler Air Force Base, teaching Vietnamese how to fly, and they were just wonderful people. I really got to enjoy meeting them. And years later, while I was out in Los Angeles, I ended up helping sponsor three of them officially and two others to get them started in the United States. And they end up calling me Dad. One of them to this day calls me Daddy.
Are you ready?
Yeah. I really enjoyed, working with the Vietnamese. I became a flight commander there as well and taught some of them how to fly. And these guys were kind of, I call the cream of the crop of Vietnam Army, and they were all young cadets or officers. And some of them were really good. We had some interesting experience with them, especially if something unusual would happen. Like one night I was at they were doing touch-and-go landings in the area at nighttime solo. And one of the young guys lost his electrical power, and the procedure was then fly over to the RSU, the runway supervisory unit, when I was controlling traffic, and rev up the engine so we'd hear them. And then we'd tell everybody to clear the traffic. Well, this one guy did it. We knew it was everybody clear out the traffic. Well, all of a sudden, three or four other young Vietnamese got sick engines or whatever. We had to land, They were scared because, one guy was having trouble. But They were nice people. They came over to the house sometimes and cooked for us as well. And I would, really enjoyed them. And later on, as I said, I ended up sponsoring some of them after the war and while I was still in California. And speaking of California, I had been in SAC early on in my career. And, of course, after going to Vietnam and the ROTC, I was out of SAC. But I got a call from a major friend of mine who was actually, Lieutenant Colonel then, who was with SAC at the Space and Missile Systems Organization in Los Angeles. And he asked me to come out and work for him out there because he was getting ready to retire and wanted me to take his place. He said, well, with your engineering background, it'll be perfect for you. Well, it was a really enjoyable assignment out there, out in Los Angeles. I was able to sit in on briefings with various high-level people that were doing scientific stuff that you wouldn't even believe even to this day. Dr. Edward Teller, the father of A-bomb, led a group that I was able to sit in on. And, you know, the three-star general at Rand Samso, they did all the really research and development for some major missiles and weapon systems out there. It was just, he was a remarkable man, Kenny Schultz. He had a $3 billion budget, which, you know, this back in the mid-70s, but, you know, he was a three-star general making, he couldn't even make all his entitlement salary because of the restrictions that they had on him. But I had three or four people working for me after the Major Ball, Colonel Ball retired. I had three or four people working for me, one in a defense support satellite program where it was a highly classified program where they could keep track of any Russian launches of anything or anybody else launches. I got to know the director of the SPO, the project officer for the global positioning system. It used to call it NAVSTAR global positioning. Eventually, everybody knows what GPS is now, and this is before it ever became airborne. And of course, the space shuttle was being developed out there too. So I got to know all those people, you know, pretty much, and I was able to work with all of those people out there. And I was a SAC representative there for Strategic Air Command. My boss was a colonel back at SAC headquarters in Offutt. He was the director of Future Systems. And so I had a man working for me in the Minuteman SPO program over at Norton Air Force Base in California. And I was at Los Angeles Air Force Station, which is not really a traditional Air Force base, but they had all the high-tech stuff there. We had the reentry vehicle program where they were studying things, and you'd go to these meetings and they'd talk about you know, things in nanoseconds. I'd say, what is a nanosecond? That's unbelievable. But the GPS system, we know it now, you know, and at that time I'd go to these technical briefings and you'd hear people talking about, well, we know we can put it on a ship or we can put it in the back of a pickup truck and we make it small enough that a man can carry it on his back out in the field, you know, soldier on the field. And now we have them that you carry in the palm of your hand or in your telephone. So it's just how technology has changed in that short period of time. So I made 05. I was a lieutenant colonel out there, and I was coming up to my four-year assignment, and I said, well, is there any way I can extend for a year to see if the first time I'd have been eligible for 06 or a full colonel, I would have had to be there one more year. And they said, no, you're going to go to either SAC headquarters or Pentagon. And I said, no, I think I've put in 21 years. I think I'm ready to go home. So that's when I retired in September of 1976.
Oh, then how did you get to Nassau County then eventually?
Nassau County, a friend of mine, I was in the oil and gas business in Houston, Texas, and bought a big compressor from a guy with Ingersoll Rand, and later he went in business for himself and did quite well, and he bought a condo here and invited me to Fernandina Beach, and I said, where's Fernandina Beach? And so I came out here, and we fell in love with this place and went back to Texas and sold our house, and here we are, and enjoying every minute of it.
That's great.
Any questions?
Just a wonderful interview, Bob.
Great interview.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing your recollections with us for the benefit of our nation. Thank you for your service. This concludes the interview with Robert Hippler.